Up next on JusticeFound.org, Willen Washington and David Korsmeyer interview Mitch Braff, founder and executive director of the Jewish Partisans Education Foundation. Today on the Worker Justice Talk, they discuss Mitch's work with the foundation and shed some light on who the Jewish Partisans were. This is David J. Korsmeyer from the Justice Foundation, and I am excited to bring you another edition of the Worker Justice Talk with the host, Roland Washington.
This is Roland Washington for JusticeFound.org. We're going to interview Mitch Braff, the executive director, founder of the Jewish Partisan Education Foundation. And then also I have with me David J. Korsmeyer.
How you doing?
And we're going to talk to Mitch about the Jewish Partisans. Mitch.
Yes, Will.
How are you doing, my brother?
It is so good to be here. I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm still hanging in there. I kind of ran across you via Brian Gaines and the Joshua Ventures about, God, it feels like yesterday.
Back in the day.
Yeah, it wasn't yesterday. And you were making, no, you had finished the film.
Exactly. That was the first film that I made about the Jewish Partisans.
And who are the Jewish Partisans?
Well, that is a question that I get asked all the time, and I'm very happy to answer that. Most people don't know that during World War II, there were approximately between 20 and 30,000 Jews who escaped the ghettos and work camps, primarily, and they're from other areas as well, and formed organized resistance groups all throughout Europe. So this is not just in Eastern Europe, like, for instance, Poland and what at the time was the Soviet Union, but also in places like France and Belgium and Greece and Italy.
And how did this come to your attention? Did you have somebody in your family that was a partisan? Or?
No, I didn't. My background, as you started to talk about, was film. And so about almost 7 years ago, I was introduced to a man who lives in the East Bay who was described to me as a Jewish partisan. And I didn't know what a Jewish partisan was. And so I met this guy, and he had an incredible story. When he was 15 years old, he was living in a ghetto, as, you know, most Jews in Eastern Europe, that were still alive, were forced to live in ghettos and be in work camps basically as slaves when the Germans took over those countries. And so he was in Lithuania in 1942. He, like thousands and thousands of other Jews in Lithuania, were forced to live in a ghetto. And he heard that there were a group of Russian partisans. I don't want to get too complicated, but basically, during World War II, the Germans and the Russians made a non-aggression treaty in 1939. And in 1941, the Germans broke that treaty and started moving east. And Lithuania and Poland and other countries were taken over after 1941 by the Germans. And many of the Russian soldiers were killed. Many of them were put in concentration camps, and many of them hid in what happened to be very dense forest and swamps. And they were really some of the first partisans. And a partisan is really an old-school word for a resistance fighter. And so these Russian partisans started to form these groups way hundreds of miles behind the front, trying to fight against the Germans. Now, this guy, his name was Murray. Murray heard that there were these Russian partisans, these resistance fighters, about 80 kilometers outside of his ghetto. And so he was 15 years old. He escaped the ghetto with a uniform that he got somehow of a Lithuanian soldier. He was pretending he was a Lithuanian soldier going back home that was injured. And he went 80 kilometers, and he found a group of Russian partisans, the very group he was looking for. And he said to these guys, he said, "Hey, I'd like to join the group." And they see this 15-year-old Jewish kid, and these, you know, many of the partisans, even though that the Jews and the Lithuanians in this case wanted to fight, they were fighting against the same enemy, because he was Jewish, and they were very anti-Semitic. They ultimately just wanted to tease him, and they were probably didn't want to let him into the group because he was Jewish. And they said, "All right, do you have a gun?" Which was a ridiculous question, because there's no way this 15-year-old had a gun. And he said, "No, I said, I just walked 80 kilometers. I want to join this group. I'd like to fight against the Germans." And again, they said, "No." They said, "Do you have any money?" 15 years old, he said, "No, I don't have any money." I'd like to fight. They said, no, if you can go and steal a gun, maybe you can join this group, our group. Now imagine being 15 years old, very, very far away from home, not knowing a soul, and you have to come up with a gun. It was basically a fool's errand. They wanted to send him on this trip that he would ultimately get killed. He amazingly got a gun. He brought them back. They allowed him because he was so brave. This little kid with nothing got a weapon. And he joined this partisan group, this, where there were Jews, a minority of Jews, and mostly Lithuanians fighting the Germans. He ultimately, at 16, was in the group. He was blowing up a German train that was supplying troops and spare parts. The Russians would use, rather the Germans would use the rail system to supply the Russian front. And at 16, he was blowing up this train with other Jewish teenagers and other partisans. And when I heard that, I saw myself at 16. At the 16, I was living in Marin. I was going to Redwood High School here in California. And I couldn't believe that my life was really pretty cushy. At 16, there's a girl I was hoping to invite to the prom. I was hoping to get my driver's permit. And here you had this 16-year-old Jewish kid blowing up trains. And on doing research, I said there were 20,000 to 30,000 people like this guy Murray. And it really blew me away. So that story of these young kids fighting, standing up against the strongest army in the world at the time and winning really inspired me.
Why do you think the story hadn't been told?
Well, it's an interesting question. Many of the people who were partisans, who were resistance fighters, felt very privileged. If you ask them why, you know, wow, you survived, you fought back as a partisan, you know, were you braver than the other people? Were you more heroic than the other people? Were you stronger? And they would say, no, we're luckier. But they had opportunities. You know, they zigged and the other guy zagged and they missed the bullet, right? Mm. This guy in Murray's case, he had knowledge. We say, you know, three things: knowledge, opportunity, and luck. So he had knowledge that there was a partisan group outside that might be able to take him as a Jew. He had the opportunity, right, that he could leave the ghetto, say goodbye to his parents, and get this uniform, but he could still leave. And he had luck that he just didn't get killed walking 80 kilometers through enemy territory. And I think that if you talk to partisans, they will say that they were luckier. And when most, you know, in this country, when most Holocaust survivors really did not talk about their experience, it's quite interesting. For the most part, until the civil rights movement in this country, when it was okay to be a foreigner, to be someone from another place,
sure.
The people came from, you know, other countries, they came from Europe. And they wanted to fit in, and then they realized that there were other people also from other places who were oppressed and were talking about their stories and were talking about empowerment. Then many of the stories started to come out.
What happened to our guy's family? He left the family. What happened to them?
Well, it's an interesting story. He left his family and ultimately went back into the ghetto to try to save them, and was ultimately then taken by the Germans in a death march. And miraculously, that death march, when they found that they'd basically marched people, dozens and dozens of miles through the snow to kill them in one location, so they wouldn't have to dispose of they wouldn't have to dispose of the bodies. And on that death march, he was able to survive.
But not his people.
I'm embarrassed that I can't tell you all the story because I just don't recall.
They're sure, sure.
So fortunate to talk to so many people.
Sure.
Many of the partisans didn't want to tell their story to take away from these other people, these survivors who didn't have the opportunity to fight back. And I think that they felt that they wanted to show respect at the beginning by not telling their stories and not trying to take attention from the people, because in some ways it's very empowering to fight back. Even though these people, the partisans, lost, many of them lost their entire families. They were the only people to survive in many cases. Some of them survived with parts of their family. Everybody had losses, even partisans.
So Mitch, when you go about deciding, you know, for the moment you decided, hey, this is a great story, what's your next move? I mean, what did you do next? You found this guy. How do you go research a story to find people who don't want to actually tell their story, or to go find these people who, probably many of whom are no longer, you know, living.
Well, it's an interesting, I mean, so basically, you know, I met this guy, and I was, you know, my background is in film, and so I first saw this as a short dramatic film, which I would still love to make one day. And it seemed like what an interesting story to have these teenage protagonists and trying to get into this partisan group and what happened. And then in doing research, one thing led to another, and I met someone at one of the people who run the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, Rabbi Abraham Cooper. And he made me appreciate there really hasn't been a lot of work with this subject of the partisans. And the idea then changed to, well, why not, instead of making a film, before this I had a film and new media company and worked with a lot of Fortune 500 companies doing short films and DVD, CDs, and websites. So I had an interest in new media. And so I said, well, what if we made a wonderful educational resource where we could teach about this in schools, not just one film that would get shown around in classrooms or perhaps film festivals, but what if we did interviews with maybe 50 partisans, and from that we would make a curriculum and an interactive website. As you know, our website, www.jewishpartisans.org, has interviews, clips from over 40 people online. We have about 18 pieces of printed curriculum you can download online. We have short films that we've made. We've made 8 films so far, and you can watch them online. These are films narrated by Larry King, Ed Asner, and Tova Felchu, which has a compilation from over these 40 interviews that we've done, and a few interviews that other people have done for us.
What would you say the history books are going to remember about the Jewish partisans? Has this story been recorded in the history books, or is this something that sort of slipped through the cracks, like so many things?
Well, again, I think, you know, so it's in some ways a little complicated why it's been, you know, why it hasn't really been spoken of that much. But I think that, you know, we're very proud that I think a lot of the work that we're doing. In fact, there's a brand new history book that I'd love to get you the information so you could share with anybody listening later, that actually has used some of our material. It's a brand new history book for teaching the Holocaust. And it has some of our material. Organizations from the U.S. Holocaust Museum, Simon Wiesenthal Center, Museum for Jewish Heritage, Anti-Defamation League, all these organizations use our material in the teaching, because there really hasn't been a lot of material. So one of the things that I think that we will hope to influence is in future versions of textbooks, they will include materials about the partisans. I should say the state of New Jersey and the state of California currently are mandated to teach the Holocaust in public schools. And both those states have adopted our material as part of the official state curriculum on teaching the partisans. So it's not in a textbook, it's something recommended to teachers and educators all across these states, you know, potentially reaching millions of people just in these two states. So our ultimate goal, our ultimate vision, is that you wouldn't go through a, you know, in a secular school, in a private school, you know, parochial school, you would have your education, your world history, your Holocaust education would definitely include the partisans. If you did a poll now and asked kids how many people know about the Jewish partisans, I would say 98% have no idea. When we do teacher conferences, the significant majority, 90% of teachers don't know they were Jewish partisans. But our goal would be to change that. We also work in the Jewish community, where we're teaching about the partisans to that community, because for Jewish kids, looking at themselves and looking at their ancestors, many Jewish kids, even like myself, I'm Jewish, and even though I didn't have any ancestors, family who were in the partisans or really in the Holocaust, I felt as part of my identity, as, you know, my people have an identity of being victims. And this is not just the Holocaust. For, you know, many, you know, thousands of years, Jews have been persecuted. And there really isn't a lot of stories of Jews fighting back and standing up. And here you have the stories of the partisans. And to Jewish kids, it's ultimately a story of these are, you know, Jewish teens, just like the teens that we might teach at a, you know, a Jewish summer camp, a synagogue, a Jewish school, a Jewish youth group. We say to the kids, these are, you know, Jewish kids just like you who stood up to tyranny and oppression and made a difference. What a great story. It's also, it's a, you know, to a Jewish audience, it's a Jewish teen empowerment story. And to a non-Jewish audience, this is a story about teens in general, and what incredible things young people can do, that young people can make a difference. Look what these kids did. It's just incredible. They stood up to the strongest army at the time and won and helped win.
Yeah, know your history, know yourself. It seems like it's that same kind of consciousness that Black Americans have, where they're fixated on being slaves. A lot of Blacks haven't established a consciousness that for you to be here meant somebody was strong enough to survive for you to be here. Ourselves, we have examples of people fighting back, people never backing down. The cities that they started when they were destroyed, Blacks still moved to another city, started over again, but the history is all fragmented, and then you buy into the overall stereotype. And one thing that I noticed, I haven't seen the newer movies, but I know when I met you back in the day, all those people, on one hand, they were saying that, well, you know, I did what I had to do, and this, but you could tell they were proud, and they were proud of what they did, even though they were saying, I had to go. And I think one of the women at that time, I think she said she was actually thrown out to be saved, and et cetera, et cetera. But then you could still see she had this pride that she fought back and fought for her people. And that's very inspiring. If the, like you said, the only history you have is that you're a victim, and you were victimized in this portion of history, and then you were victimized in another portion of history, and you're right. That's healing, and that's empowering, and it dispels a lot of myths.
I would agree. I think there's a lot of parallels if you look at just, you know, what you're saying in terms of the Jewish experience, you know, and the Black experience. I mean, it's just, you know, in terms of that, I mean...
Yeah, they had it where, what, one Jew and one Black can go get into med school or whatever, and then you guys were boxers before we were, and then basketball players, and then one of the best basketball games ever played was against the Jewish brothers and the Black teams in the segregated days, and then everything, we either did it at the same time or based on persecution, the Jewish brothers and sisters came a step ahead of us, and always marginalized. It's like no matter what these feats were, what's it called? Larry Brown, I believe he played in that famous game in New York during the segregated leagues, and then he went and played on the Olympic team for Israel too, right?
Right, right.
And then he came back and coached the brothers and run. You know, this guy has done all this stuff, but they just actually, because I'm sure of his name too, he's Larry Brown, but it doesn't sound like people really equate that. This guy dealt with a lot of segregation and then still stayed in this institution of sports. And I don't know, maybe we could still say he's being segregated. Who knows? But you know what? You kind of get the gist of what I'm saying.
I think there's a lot of similarities. That's why you think you have a lot of Jews very active in the civil rights movement and other, you know, and the labor movement.
Yep.
These are, you know, I think people who have been persecuted really sympathize with other people. And trying to find that. So there is a really interesting parallel history there for sure.
Yeah, 1199 in New York was pretty much run by Jews, and actually the people that they went against were the Jewish hospitals, and they had Blacks and Jews, and they called that Martin Luther King's union, and they were the first one. I believe they were like really the first labor union that actually elevated a lot of Blacks in high positions. The original 1199. So what are some of the things you guys are doing now?
Well, you know, we have something called the Resist curriculum, and that we really divide it into four areas. And so when we realize we teach about the partisans, it's not just a history story, right? It's not just history where you're going to teach around. There's a national Holocaust commemoration day, usually in the spring, in April. And we realize that, you know, the partisans, as I mentioned, is a story of young people can make a difference. And so we have a curriculum that deals as four legs. It has history, of course, but it also deals with leadership, values, and heroes. And so we realize that expanding it, so now we are bringing our material to areas where you wouldn't normally talk to, like the Holocaust. We were at there's a summer camp near Yosemite, Camp Tawanga, and we did one program. We're going to go there again next week, and so we're really doing programs where most people wouldn't take this content, because when we position it as this is a story of teen empowerment, it really reaches a much broader audience.
Yes.
Than if we said this is a, you know, this is a Holocaust story. And so we've really been able to expand the interest and reach more people, which is ultimately what we want to do. We want to teach people about the partisans.
And how do the partisans feel?
You know, it's I had some of the, you know, the best compliments, I think, of my life through some of these partisans, the people that I've been really working tirelessly to tell their story. They said, you know, like, you know, you put us on the map.
Yeah.
And that people would feel that their story would have been forgotten. And that people wouldn't do it. And I think that I've been very fortunate. I was taken with this story. I was very fortunate to be able to start this organization, to work with a great board, some great funders, a wonderful staff, and really do this. I think an advantage of being a small organization is that we can do what we want, you know, and make these programs relatively quickly. And so we can do things and really honor this very important population. And so I feel thrilled that they are happy and supportive of our work. It makes a very important difference to us. And the families and the children of partisans have been very involved in our work as well. Grandchildren.
So Mitch, how has the decision to use technology and sort of center your project, it sounds like, around the internet, how has that helped you? And what have you found that sort of surprised you about the use of technology, good or bad?
Well, I think everything is going to be more. I mean, it's a business word, but you know, leverage. We can leverage so much by using technology, by using the internet. Just as you know, with this, what you're doing right now, you're going to reach so many more people than you could in other mediums. I mean, we have teachers from all over the country emailing us. Giving us feedback about our material. We are reaching people when people are doing Google searches. So right now we're at a conference in St. Louis, an educators conference. One of our staff is there today. He's been there all week. And people from that conference will then be able to go to the web and download our curriculum, watch the videos, use the website. And as a small nonprofit, always, trying to be very conscious and conservative in terms of how we're spending our donors' money, we can really have a service where people can get everything from the web. And it really, so it, as a business, as a nonprofit business, it keeps our costs down tremendously and allows us to reach an audience, you know, many, many more times we could if this was before the internet, where we would go to a conference and hand something out to people. Now we can communicate through email, through newsletters, through, you know, having the videos online are really wonderful.
So you don't feel like you've lost anything by not, say, having a textbook that can be sold and distributed and, you know, purchased through Amazon or what?
We're much broader than that. Yeah. I mean, I think that we have, you know, many tactics to get our, to teach about the partisans, to really honor our mission. And so, sure, it would be wonderful to, as I mentioned, that we kind of facilitated being in a textbook, mm-hmm. but we see it as a multi-pronged approach. So I think that the internet is really leverageable for us to expand significantly. I think one of the things we're going to look for in the future will be teacher training online. So right now, we teach hundreds of teachers a year all across the country, primarily in the Bay Area, but all across the country, about the partisans. And we focus in three geographic areas, the San Francisco Bay Area, Los Angeles, and the kind of New York, New Jersey metropolitan areas. And if you're a teacher outside of that area, we're not set up to serve you. Mm-hmm. And what a missed opportunity, right? For us as well as a teacher. So if we can develop, you know, online learning, and take some of our teacher trainings and put that online, I think we can reach a much broader audience than we physically could going to Kansas City, going to Chicago, going to Detroit, going to other areas where there are people interested in this, and we won't be able to serve them. Hmm.
And also your information is available 24/7, and so anybody in the world can click and hear these short documentaries.
Absolutely, they can watch the films. They can download the study guide. You can even go to our website and ask partisans questions online.
Oh,
something you couldn't do with other technology. Hmm. and so we really try to make it accessible. We made a 3D model to look like it, it's a virtual partisan bunker. So we spent about a year working with a very talented 3D artist and a partisan, and his wife, who's an artist, and the partisan had wrote a manuscript a few years after he was fortunate to survive, and he actually first moved to Israel, and he wrote this manuscript, and it described his physical conditions. They lived in these underground bunkers that basically, and they would be half underground, half above ground, so they could be concealed. So in the forest, people couldn't see them. And remember, people in these areas didn't have in many cases fur coats, didn't have warmth, didn't have shelter. Just they had to live outside in the forest under conditions that would make probably the equivalent of living in Chicago in the winter, just freezing. And I've always been fascinated about these bunkers and how they lived. Maybe it was just being a kid and liking forts all the time, right? And so basically, we made this 3D model that you can go to our website. That is at www.jewishpartisans.org, and you can actually look at this 3D model yourself online on the web in your living room on your own time. And you couldn't do that with any other technology. You can make a CD-ROM and give it to a school, but that your distribution is much smaller.
And we're going to ask people to check the site out. But as a point of reference, wants folks to remember that there was a war going on. As this man just stated, it was freezing conditions. People were fighting for their lives. They were starving. So even though people are giving out, telling their stories, it's still hard to accept the conditions that they were under. And you're really talking about people's really stepping up and then fighting the good fight, and then living through it, and then living to this day.
Absolutely. It really is an incredible story, and it is what you said. I think unless it's very hard to understand the context of World War II and the context of the Holocaust, where, where 6 million Jewish people were murdered, and people were being hunted down, and people were having, scientific experiments were made on Jews, and it was just the most terrible situation people can imagine. I was actually in Lithuania 2 weeks ago in a place called Ponar, which is outside of Vilnius, which used to be was known as the Jerusalem of Europe. It had a huge, thriving Jewish community, and outside, 100,000 Jews were murdered and put in these pits. They now have a monument at these pits. But it's very hard to appreciate. It's very hard to imagine where people would be rounded up, forced to live in ghettos, and just murdered routinely. 1,000 people a day at times were taken to these pits, which they were told were work camps. They weren't telling people they would be killed. They'd tell people they're going to go to a work camp so they could work. It's a slave labor. And people realize, well, I'll go to the work camp. At least I'll live. But they were manipulated and brought there, and ultimately murdered. I mean, 100,000 people, not a very large area, in 11 pits. And I think when you put yourself in and see the forest surrounding the pits, and the forest is where a lot of partisans lived because they had great camouflage in there. And for me, it was very powerful to see the forest where the partisans lived, surrounding these pits where so many Jewish people were murdered.
And then one of your original points that you had made when you stated, when I believe you said his name was Murray, when he finally found the Russian partisans, here they're fighting this common enemy, the Germans, the Nazis, and yet the Russians were still willing to discriminate against him because he was Jewish. In the middle of this war, freezing, you're starving, and then still you're going to have these racial issues in the middle of a war.
I know, it's really great to say, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But that was not the case if you were a Jew in Eastern Europe. Now, I should say that Jewish partisans in places like Italy, where there was less anti-Semitism to begin with, for the most part, did not experience the kind of anti-Semitism Jews did in Poland, Lithuania, and in Russia. In fact, many Jews from those three areas that I just mentioned would say that the local populations, they were more scared of them. Those people killed more Jews than the Germans did.
Amazing.
And these are people who were neighbors of people. Literally, the people who... There's a woman on our website. Her name is Gertrude Boyarski. She lives in Florida today. And she and her family escaped, and they were hiding in the forest. And, you know, to make a long story, you know, condense it, and you could read this on our website, and you could see a film we have about her, about women partisans. But she basically was... People from the town came in, and they murdered many people who were hiding in the forest. And at this point, she wasn't in a partisan group. She was in a group called a family camp, which was a little satellite camp of people who weren't fighters. These are, many cases, women, children, the elderly, people who were not necessarily going to be accepted into a fighting partisan unit. And a guy who she was in high school with, who she took a dance class with, who was her dance partner, has a machine gun and has her on her knees and her mother and her brother, and they are begging for their lives, and he shoots all of them, and her mother falls down and her brother falls down, and she feels the bullets going by her face, and she falls down and he leaves. Now, miraculously, Gertie is not shot at all. She looks at, you know, she's a religious woman. She says, look, the hand of God came and saved her. There's no way that at point blank he could have missed her. And her, basically, her mother and her brother are killed at that day. And she cleans herself up, and she walks to the partisan group and tries to join this partisan group. But, I mean, just imagine that. Someone you went to high school with, someone you were in a dance class with, you held hands with, is all of a sudden shooting you because you're Jewish, because you're different than everybody else.
In the middle of a war.
In the middle of a war. And that you're forced to live in a forest, you're forced to leave your home because people want to kill you.
Not a lot more to say to that.
Yeah, I mean, it really, you know, it's powerful stories. But, you know, that said, you know, Gertie, and just to tell, you know, what I think is so empowering about the stories of the partisans is that the same young woman who was perhaps 16 or 17 when this happened, joins a partisan group, is accepted, and she's now in a Russian partisan group, a Soviet group. And in the Soviets celebrate International Women's Day, which is still celebrated today. I believe it's in May or March. And to celebrate that, she tells her commander, her and her girlfriend, are going to burn down a German bridge that the Germans use in a town to bring troops and supplies over, and as their kind of gift, as a present for International Women's Day. And the commander doesn't believe. He says, all right, you two girls are going to do that? Yeah, sure, you're going to do that. We have to bring back proof. So Gertie and her girlfriend, both teenagers, go down to the town. They get, you know, they get supplies, they get kerosene, they get hay. The town doesn't want to support. They want to help them. They force the town to give them this. They burn down the bridge. They're being shot at while they're in the water, putting the kerosene and the hay on the bridge. The bridge burns down. They're being shot at. They take a burnt piece of the bridge after the bridge collapses, and they give it back to the commander. And they are given a Medal of Lenin from this Russian partisan group, which at the time is the highest medal for a partisan valor from a Soviet group. And so you have on one end this young girl losing her entire family, and on this other end that she's able to stand up and to do something and really to fight back against the people who were oppressing her, and to fight back against tyranny and to do what she can to slow down the Germans. As a kid, as a high school age girl, it's amazing. What I get out of this, you know, I've done this for about 7 years now. I didn't think this would be... This turned into a job for me. This turned into a career. This turned into a profession and a profession. We have a small staff of 5 people now. We bring this all over the country. The story of the partisans is ultimately about young people standing up against tyranny and oppression and making a difference. It's a story in some ways of questioning authority. It's a story of, I think, that we can really get a lot out of today. I think that is it's really a story about youth empowerment, that young people can really do anything. I think there's a lot of lessons and a lot of parallels in today's society that we can get by looking at the partisans. And I would just say that, you know, I'm very glad, Roland, to have me on, David, to have me on this. And if people want to learn more about the partisans, they can go to www.jewishpartisans.org. People can email me directly, mitch@jewishpartisans.org, and we would be happy to help with our educator staff. Is to, if any educators out there, if people want us to go into your community, we would be happy to help, you know, supply with materials or even training if that is possible. And we really want to, you know, to people out there, is to help us, you know, share the story. We're making great strides, and with, you know, this opportunity you've given me today to talk about the partisans and our organization, I think we'll even go further. So thank you.
Thank you.
Are you a small business or entrepreneur? You know you need to be online, but you don't know where to start? Come to RedTap. We'll help you with all of your online needs. Everything from website design to e-commerce site setup to e-marketing. We'll speak to you in your language and help you build a successful online business. Give us a call at 415-285-0585. RedTap is located in the heart of the Mission District at 1360 Valencia Street and is a proud sponsor of the JusticeFound.org podcast. You've been listening to the Worker Justice Talk podcast edition with Roland Washington. The Worker Justice Talk is a production of JusticeFound.org and RedTap. Most editions are recorded live at the studios of RedTap, located in the heart of the Mission District in San Francisco. The Worker Justice Talk is available online at justicefound.org and for download on iTunes. The post-production audio engineer was me, David J. Kordsmeyer. Join us next time for another edition of the Worker Justice Talk.